Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the Saleri Report, a man who needs no introduction. The Saker, who joined us last year on Quarterly Reports, he's going to be joining us this year on the Quarterly Reports, given what's just happened since our last Quarterly Report. We can't wait to talk with him about two developments. One is what, of course, is going on in the world, but the other is he has a new book. So, Saker, welcome to the Saleri Report.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure and an honor.
So before we dive in, I want to talk about your new book, because I had the pleasure of reading it this prior weekend, and it's sold out already. We're waiting for new batches. So it's quite popular. So let's start there. Tell us about your new book, what it is, when it was written. I love the foreword, naturally, because I wrote it. Tell us about the book and how it's doing.
It's doing very well. It is basically a sequel to the first book, The Essential Saker One. It is basically a collection of what I consider my most relevant analyses written over the past roughly year plus, basically since the last book came out. So it's directly a sequel with the same notion, you know, grouped by categories, discussion of the Ukraine, of things such as the phenomenon of Russophobia, military issues, of course, the Trump vote. I still repeat it because I thought it was important. I think this is a really important topic. I did repost fully my articles on Russia and Islam with a couple of additions to it. So because I think that's one worth actually hammering in over and over again. I discuss other issues, developments in Russia, the way Russians deal with counter-propaganda, for instance. Relationship between Putin and Israel, which is often misunderstood, and actually I'm writing yet another article on that these days. So it's basically an updated version of the first book.
Well, it's interesting because the first book was much funnier. This book is a little bit more serious, but the thing I found really valuable is, one, you get a much more intimate understanding of Russia and the Russian point of view and how different Russia is from most cultures that either are in America or Americans interact with. You know, it's a very different point of view, and you go back into the history of both why that is, and both recent history and then, you know, medieval, literally back to the Roman Empire, and the difference between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Vatican. So one is a much deeper understanding of Russia, but then I think there's a lot more insight about the details of the military balance of power, which I found to be both fascinating and very, very useful, because there's no other place to get that kind of insight.
You're very kind. There's not much in English, I would say. I would want to mention that I have the highest regards for Professor Stephen Cohen.
Right.
Consider the top specialist on Russia, and I would say he touches. We might differ on our analyses and perceptions and views on certain issues, but if you want to get rock solid information about Russia in English, I would start with what Professor Cohen writes.
Right. I regularly post whenever he does an interview. I try and regularly post his interviews. I think it's very good. Okay, well, let's just dive in and talk about one of the things I really valued about your book is you hit the whole Zyokon, as Cynthia McKinney would say, Zyokon or neocon issue straight up and very hard, both in the context of what's happening in the United States, but also what's happened in Russia. Anytime any affiliated groups of the Zyokons have run Russia. So I just think that is a topic that needs to get teed up. Cynthia and I have talked a lot about it on the Saleri Report over the last year. Who in the world are the Zyokons? Who are the world, or the neocons, or as you call it, the Zionist occupation government?
Well, that's not my expression. I just used it because I think that's basically what we're dealing with now, but I fully am aware of the racist overtones of that expression. I just think that to use it now is a way of raising the alarm. But the issue really, the first thing I would say, because I'm walking a very thin path, I would say, because I feel that the public discourse and the analysis of the role of, we can call it organized Jewish elites, I think would be one appropriate term. It's difficult because on one hand, we have some people who think, you know, the Jews are doing this and that, and basically present Jews and their majority as a united political group with a specific agenda that it's
Which
pursuing.
Clearly is not true. Yeah, it's not true.
No, absolutely not. This is ridiculous. On the other hand, we have people who basically, with their thesis is Jews have no influence whatsoever in world politics, and if they do have it, it's always benign and it's always wonderful. I think both of these groups are highly misleading. They're hijacking the discussion, which should be a far more refined, and it's an extremely important one, because what we do see, I think, in the United States today is, I would even say, a small set of Jews in generally. It is a crucial part of what in France is called organized Jewry. I don't know if that word is used in English or not. But as we're talking about organized elites, groups that are not, you know, have very little popular or democratic representation. I'm not sure what the numbers are in the United States, but for instance, in France, there's an extremely influential group called the CRIF, which is the, let's see, how would you translate that? It would be the a committee of representatives in French Jewish institutions, who always speaks in the name of all French Jews. And the reality is that they represent something in the range of 5% of French Jews.
Right.
And I don't know what the numbers would be with AIPAC in the United States or other groups, which are even more extremist. But it doesn't really matter. What we do have here is several, if I may say, parallel things that need not to be confused. First, there's a neocon phenomenon, which is a purely ideological constellation of people and who are united by a specific mindset and political goals. Then there is the Israel lobby, which is interested in Israel-linked lobbies, which neocons also do, but not exclusively at all. And I do, to some degree, agree with Professor Chomsky that it's, there are situations where clearly the Israel lobby is running the U.S., but we have seen the reverse, too, where the USA is using Israel as a pit bull to advance its political agenda. And then we have other Jewish organizations with different degree, with, you know, it's actually a very diverse community. One parallel that comes to mind is when I hear people in the United States say, the Muslims, they and Islam, it. No.
Right.
You know, the Muslims are extremely diverse group.
Right.
It's not to deny that in some countries they can, some groups, some subset of Muslims can be very influential, and that's what we have in the United States. We definitely do have, I call them Zionists because I refer to a specific ideology. We
Right.
definitely have the Zionists prevailing very strongly over what I used to call the old Anglo Guard, or what we usually see as U.S. imperialists. I think that's absolutely true. I don't think that this is a matter of spot the Jew. That's, I think, is absolutely ridiculous, because the
Right.
very same Professor Koeng that I praised is also Jewish.
Right.
And it hardly makes him a Zionist or a neocon or any kind of, you know, Zog member. So
one thing you make very clear in the book, which I think was a very good point and resonates with my experience, you're talking about 1%, you know, a 1% elite who really doesn't care about the other 99%. So,
absolutely.
So, you're talking about 1% of a Jewish elite that really doesn't care about the Jewish people, so,
yes,
which is why it's certainly not a monolith. Right.
Absolutely. And most Jews today are still opposed to Trump, even though that elite, that AIPAC and associated elite, I think is really, really took over the Trump administration.
Right.
So it's a very difficult line to walk, because basically if you try to understand what's happening, you get blasted by both sides, who are pursuing a totally different agenda, which is one that has to be black and white. Basically, people like to have simple categories. Either the Jews are good or the Jews are bad, and that's all they're comfortable with. The same thing again with Islam. You know, Muslims bad or Muslims good. That's it. That's how we stop the conversation. And
right.
I think that is extremely unhelpful, because we're dealing with potentially very dangerous phenomena. And it's ugly. It's an ugly mindset.
So let me just tell you one story that I think is important to sort of get it off my chest. When I grew up in Philadelphia and went to a Quaker school that was downtown, and the population was about 50 or 60% Jewish, and all my best friends were Jewish, and I was very much part of that life. And then I went to New York and worked on Wall Street, and again was very much part of my life. And so by the time I left the administration and started Hamilton Securities, that world was my world. I didn't think of it as something that was separate from me. And when the litigation began, remember, when the litigation began, I was building a software tool that would map the money in places, and particularly you could see the intersection between the mortgage fraud and the narcotics trafficking. So, you know, we were showing maps of South Central LA. When we got targeted by the Department of Justice and, you know, when I went into my 11 years enemy of the state period, in the first couple of years, every person I knew who was Jewish dropped me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had said to me that that was possible, it was a little bit like losing your family. I didn't know it was part of another world. I didn't know I was separate from that world. I didn't think, you know, it was, yeah, there's a great scene in The Godfather when the Michael's mother says to him, "You can't lose your family."
You know? Mm-hmm.
And but the speed at which all, you know, it seemed to spread and I get dropped, it was almost as though there was a field, and that field was deeply dependent on the drug business, and I was persona non grata.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have told you that that couldn't have happened. And it was very interesting because one of the reasons I moved to Tennessee was I live in a neighborhood where there are very few, you know, it's mostly Protestant, and it was really for safety reasons. Mm-hmm. And when I first started to get clients who were Jewish and start to interact with Jewish people, you know, it was a big change for me because I literally was in such a state of culture shock about the whole thing. So whatever's going on, there absolutely is a tribal phenomena, both financially and culturally. And I, you know, before it started, I would have said that couldn't have happened, you know, that there was no such thing.
Well, let me share something of my own experience here because I think it fully applies. Tribal phenomena are extremely important when you're engaged in any kind of high-risk business, be it legal or illegal.
Right.
And I'll give you a totally different example. Albanians in Switzerland.
Right.
They are known to run a very substantial part of the drug business. And why are they so successful at it? Because they have a different language that most Swiss people don't understand, including people involved in policing, in counter-narcotics, in counterintelligence, etc. Secondly, it's an environment which is extremely hard to infiltrate because it's essentially tribal. People know each other for generations.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that, you know how you say that, for instance, why is there so much corruption in the world of intelligence? Because everything is classified and secret, and when you put national security stamp on something, it's very easy to hide corruption.
Right.
Same thing happens for tribalism, any form of tribalism, and I don't think it's at all specific to Jews. Mind you, the vast majority of Albanians in Switzerland have nothing to do with that. Again, we're talking about a subset of a small percentage. But what is absolutely true is that within any ethnic group or tribal group, you can create a subset that is very, very safe for you to use if you're engaged in any high-risk activity. That actually even applies to Russia. A lot of people say that Putin has surrounded himself to St. Petersburg, people who came from St. Petersburg. Well, because he knows them for many years.
Right.
So you have loyalty, you have secrecy.
Well, to a certain extent,
I don't think Jews are in any way different from any other group who has some kind of external, an easy, convenient way to identify the loyal guy and work with him. You create loyalties that way.
Right.
But I don't think there's anything specific to Jews to that. Now, some Jews engage in, I think, overtly racist ideology. I think both rabbinical Judaism and Zionism engage in this entire concept that they are, you know, different from the rest of mankind. And I'm fully aware of the racist, messianic ideology of some Jews. But most of them don't actually share it at all. And if I can, finally, if I could also share something of my own experience, you know, when I was going through the worst time in my life first in Switzerland, the people who helped me most out of the kindness of her heart were actually Jews.
Right.
And it's been something funny in my entire family. We were refugees. We went through difficult times in different countries. And, you know, on a very regular basis, we were helped by Jews who knew fully well that we were not Jews.
Right.
So this kind of tribalism separate this mentality of us and them is something that some people, I think all tribes develop that. You'll find that subset among other groups. I don't think there's anything specific to Jews in it.
Well, when I grew up in Philadelphia, there were three groups that cooperated and competed in terms of the running organized crime. So you had the Masons, who ran the banks and the law firms. You had the Vatican, which was the Jesuits, but they ran the ports and the police and a lot of the sort of distribution. And then you had the Jews, who were smaller than the first two groups, but they sort of overpunched their weight. And they competed and cooperated. And sometimes when you look at the world, it's almost as though the pilgrims have decided to take a duck ever since they kind of gave up on the country in 1995. But things are getting a lot more tribal and the cooperation is breaking down. It's almost as though as the rule of law breaks down, you fall back on your tribes, and the tribes are getting more competitive and intolerant for a variety of reasons. I think one of which is, oddly enough, military technology. But, there's definitely a tribal phenomena going on that I'm watching. And, you talk a little bit about it with respect to Islam. And it's complicated, as you say, because there is no one they. I always laugh when people talk about the U.S. government. I'm like, white U.S. government. There are 50 U.S. governments, and
absolutely,
they're all fighting and competing.
Agree.
Right.
And not only
right.
that, but there's two things that we're observing nowadays in the United States, and it all began with Obama. Obama was the first, well, probably was even W before him, but under Obama it became clear that the nominal head of the United States basically disappeared. It was such chaos at the top that the various agencies start having their own foreign policy, which is
right.
very typically what happens when any kind of regime becomes weak. Secondly, various groups who jointly benefit from a polity or a political regime like the United States, they will work together very well as long as the system works. But when there are cracks in the system, when the system starts collapsing, and I contend that the United States is a deep, deep, deep crisis,
right.
that triggers internal infighting.
Right.
Which means that one group will probably crush the other one or attempt to do so, and it will become even nastier and more overt. It's sort of a coming out when you see the elites that you really didn't suspect, because all regimes like to present themselves as very united. But when the crisis comes in, we saw that in Nazi Germany. Just look at when the German generals tried to blow up Hitler. It wasn't when things were going well.
Right.
We saw it very powerfully after the revolution in Russia. There was absolute chaos, and suddenly the Trotskyists and the anti-Trotskyists got at each other's throats because it was a matter of survival of their entire system that they had built. And I think we see that today. We see a very dangerous dynamic where I really do think that the United States currently is decapitated, at least formally. I don't think the White House is functional. We see different groups and agencies, pulling the agenda towards what they want. And unfortunately,
right.
yes, we're seeing the neocons becoming absolutely, front and center stage in the decision making. And the scary thing about that is I find them probably the most dangerous group of all, because they're pure ideologues. They have no need or concept of negotiations. All they do is basically either threaten force or use force. That's the two modes they work in. And finally, I think they're not particularly bright, so they always double down. And
right.
if something goes wrong, they'll double down over it. Now, all of this together is very, very dangerous. And the problem is, coming back to your initial question, is that because the Zionists in power are so influential and dangerous right now, it is very unhelpful to have a debate which is hijacked by people who make, lists of Jews on the other hand, or pretend like there's not a problem with Zionism on the other hand, because it obfuscates the real problem. And that's my main concern.
Right. Well, so you have two groups that overlap. One is the neocons. I worked with members of that group when I was in the Bush administration. And then the other is the AIPAC and Israeli lobby. And they, as I said, they overlap. But I think the one thing I really want to stress, and the reason I wanted to focus on this point first, is they enjoy bringing chaos, and they depend on the world to bring order, before, during, and after they bring chaos. But this time around, the world may not be able to maintain the order, and they literally are, in my experience, crazy. They're just not, they're not mentally and psychologically sane. It's the only way I can describe it. I've never been able to explain their behavior, but it's basically like a mental virus. It's the only way I can describe it. They're nuts.
I would call them ideologically intoxicated.
Oh, you're so nice.
No, it's not a nice thing to say, because let's think of the applications. First of all, it means that they're not capable of judgment and they're dysfunctional. And secondly, it means that they basically have a very strong tendency towards delusional thinking. And the way I see it, the order has already broken down. And actually, I think there's more groups than that, because other groups in the United States who benefited, it's not only the neocons and the Israel lobby. There were very, if you look at
Right, everybody makes money. The war lobby makes money every time they're crazy.
Exactly.
Right.
And now they're all affected by the failures of the system. So they're all joining the fight. I mean, certainly the attitude of American generals recently has been extremely discouraging, because what we have is what Fallon called, the ass-kissing chicken shit, I think was the expression that he used speaking about Petraeus. This is what we have. All the generals around Trump are that kind of generals. They're ideological ass-kicking chicken shits who are not capable of actually doing what's right for their country or even for their own forces. They're going down an extremely dangerous path. So we have weak people combined with ideologically intoxicated people. That's an explosive combination. That's why my book, I think you said, it's more somber and less amused. Well, because I'm frightened, to be honest.
Well, one of the things I want to get to is to talk about what the chances of war are, because it's very interesting. After Davos and the State of the Union, what do you see? Suddenly we have Tillerson and Bezos in the Southern Hemisphere with their families, and looks to me, among other things, they're looking for, bunkers in the Southern Hemisphere in case there's a nuclear war.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, if there's a nuclear war, no amount of bunkers will help. I mean, I don't think that if you have any kind of understanding, and I would suspect that these people do know some basic things about nuclear war between, say, Russia and the United States, your bunkers won't help. I mean, if we're talking about full-scale nuclear war, both countries as entities basically disappear. The international economic system is basically gone, and we revert to us. Actually, we don't revert. We reach a situation which I don't think has ever been experienced in history. I don't even know how to describe that. I mean, sometimes it says, the end of the world as we know it. I think it's not a bad description of what we would be looking at. So I don't think that anybody in the United States would actually deliberately. I know that some people make that accusation that, the United States is planning a war with Russia. I don't think so. I really don't. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen, because unfortunately wars get started by miscalculation. But I can't imagine anybody being having the basic set of knowledge needed to understand what such a war would imply going, yeah, we'll try that. I don't think so.
No. Okay. Well, let's turn to the Russian canard. We've watched for more than a year while a variety of different interests try and persuade someone that the Russians interfered with the election. And the latest development is we've had the clear disclosure from a variety of different sources, including this latest memo from the House Intelligence, that, the only interference we can find so far is the Democrats paying for a dossier with help of former British intelligence and former Russian intelligence, and trying to basically create a story about it. So we see some fake evidence for a fake story. So tell us about the Russian canard. They haven't given up on it, though.
No, and I think they won't, because it's absolutely essential. It almost becomes right now. I think the United States is truly after the what I call a coup, because I do think there was a coup against Trump in January, because he came in power with one agenda and that agenda changed within 30 days. So something happened there, and I call it a coup. I think the United States is entering a completely different part of its history. And that Russian, the canard, that Russian threat is becoming part of the identity of the political establishment now. It is absolutely crucial. I think that people who are capable of critical thinking have known all along that this is nonsense. And we had this CNN producer saying that it's all, hot air and made up. We have that. I don't think anybody still capable of thinking. I'm not talking about the ideological zombies. They will buy anything. But rational people pretty much know that this is nonsense, and it doesn't make any difference because it's politically expedient. Because remember, the country is in a deep, deep crisis, and externally, there is no U.S. foreign policy left, in my opinion. It's just a series of absolute disasters and failures. So at that point, it becomes crucial to blame it on somebody. And the only somebody, I mean, for a while it was, you know, the terrorists, the GWOT, the war on terror. Now that's not having much traction, so let's get at the Russians and let's blame it all on them. And, you know, it's an enemy that irritates the U.S. elites because it's an enemy who's non-compliant. So that's the perfect target. It's the most credible enemy. So you peg anything on that. It doesn't matter. I think this is not going to change. And no amount of disclosure or whistleblowing is going to change that fundamental, crucial narrative. Just like 9-1-1 was absolutely essential to peg a full decade of U.S. foreign policy on it, the Russian threat now is essential for the U.S. elites to get anything done. So I think it's here to stay. We're going to live, and it's going to get worse.
Well, certainly, if you look at the proposals on the defense budget, it has to get worse if they're going to justify those. Well, before we go to that, let's just one of the things Joseph Farrell and I said in our news trends and stories at the beginning of the year is that this is going to be the year of the purge. And we're watching tremendous numbers of purges going on in the media and Hollywood, a lot of it revolving around sex allegations. We just saw the chairman of the RNC, Steve Wynn, have to resign. So, you know, it's a little bit, when I was in the Bush administration, we used to say we're going at each other. It's like being on a rubber lifeboat and we're going at each other with razor blades.
but it's a very good image.
Right. But it's clear the purges are upon us, and I think they're far from over, and would be curious as to what you think.
I completely agree. And it's within the logic of what's happening right now. You're having the entire system, what I call the Anglo-Zionist empire, is falling apart before our eyes. Of course, the very helpful media always pretends like it's not the case and continues to feed a bunch of delusional nonsense. But that reminds me enough of you know, when Nazi Germany was essentially reduced to Berlin, they were still discussing magic weapons and how they're going to make a brilliant counteroffensive to change the course of the war. This is the mode we're in right now. So, of course, the people who even bother to listen to the media are unaware of it. But the elites, they all know. And exactly what you're saying, they're going after each other. This is the normal human reaction. And yes, if the pie is shrinking, you're going to fight way harder for a piece of it. I think the purges is another thing that's going to continue. Absolutely.
Well, here's the thing. You're more negative on the chances for the Anglo-Zionist empire as I am. But I think once you've gone through, you know, I call it the financial coup d'etat. Once you've gone through the financial coup d'etat and you've stolen all the money, you need a different person running things than you did when you were stealing. And so the thieves leave, you know, and the engineers come back in. So, and you also need a lot fewer people. So I think this is the normal reengineering of the system. And I just think all the people who did the coup didn't understand that was a phase, you know, and out they go. So to me, this is how you bring in, you know, you get rid of a lot of people, you bring in bright, young, cheaper people, and you get rid of a lot of old, expensive people who have a lot of knowledge, which is dangerous to you.
So, yeah, but that reminds me of the hopes of reforming the Soviet Union under Gorbachev with glasnost and perestroika. It didn't work. Because the system is, first of all, I believe the system is incapable of reforming itself. And we saw that, I think, brilliantly with both Obama and Trump. Right. You know, change you can believe in, make America great again, and each time it's just nonsense. And secondly, I think the only thing that could happen would be what I thought maybe Trump would be and didn't happen, is somebody coming in with a lot of potential popularity and doing this draining the swamp thing, which can be done in very different ways. But what should have happened at the very beginning, we should have seen Trump appoint people and then immediately have purges. This is what Putin did in Russia when he came to power. He came to power, and the first thing he did, he dealt with the oligarchs. Trump had a very similar situation. Now, if some external person appears in the United States from, I don't know, whatever, a political figure or a military figure or somebody with a lot of moral authority that appeals to people, that gets a lot of support, and somehow makes it into a position of where he has actual power or she has actual power, maybe. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's too late for that, just as the Soviet Communist Party was not able to reform itself it all ended up in a collapse. And this is what I think we're going to see. I think we're going to see a very similar scenario, a collapse of the order that we have here, a transitional period of absolute chaos. And out of that chaos will eventually, I think, will emerge, of course, a force that will start rebuilding. But it's going to have to go through a collapse first.
I'm not sure. We'll see. Let's keep going. Let's turn to global. The new defense strategies, we saw the president give a speech and publish, the White House publish a national defense strategy, and then Mattis, Secretary of Defense, come out with one that was a subset of that. Explain what the new defense strategies are and what it means to America.
First and foremost, and I'm sorry if I repeat myself, it's a very good indicator of weakness, because essentially it's designed, it's much less a true military document. It's not like the normal cycle would be that you first begin by establishing threats and priorities, then you develop a strategy, then you develop how you get there, then you go into force planning, etc., and training and deployment of systems and units, etc. This is not what happened. What happens is, and this is very characteristic, other countries have done that in the past. I'm thinking particularly at Russia during the 1990s. When a country gets weak, and a country, the United States, is very weak militarily right now, you try to find a quick fix to the problem. So the problem is that the United States militarily is absolutely, ridiculously overstretched.
Right.
I mean, the task of the United States Armed Forces right now is to control the entire planet. And of course, that is not a viable strategy when countries like China and Russia are out there. It doesn't work. Even countries like the DPRK and Iran are not, something that the United States can militarily threaten anymore. So that doesn't work. So what is the solution? The first is to throw money at the problem. Hence the increases, and, we will pay more, and that's going to make us stronger again, which is absolute nonsense. The problem is, of course, in the very underlying mission of the armed forces. And secondly, what's really interesting is the new emphasis on nuclear forces. And we saw that the nuclear posture review, which was just revealed, which says something which is not false, but let me put it in context. There's actually, if you look at the documents, there is on page, 8, an interesting little chart that says nuclear delivery systems since 2010. And it shows how many new systems or updated systems were created by the Russia, China, North Korea, and the United States. And the United States is a modest little, in a little corner, there's the F-35 that could participate in the delivery of weapons. And you see all those systems developed by Russia and China and even North Korea. And it's very impressive. It gives you that image that, everybody is preparing for nuclear war except for us. We need to do something, and we will do something about it. Now, if you look at the real world, what do we really have? We have Russia and the United States with roughly 7,000 nuclear weapons. And everybody else is in the hundreds. France, China, UK, Pakistan, India, Israel, North Korea. In reality, Russia and the United States are so powerful in a nuclear sense that even, and it's true that the Russian nuclear triad right now is more modern than the American one. That makes absolutely no difference. If Russia attacked the United States could wipe out Russia completely, several
right.
times over.
Right.
So what we have here is basically psychotherapy. It's a pretense of trying to stop the breakup of the empire by pouring more money or getting more modern nukes, none of which in any way addresses the real problems.
Right.
This is another, and the key thing is here. When countries feel militarily confident, they don't talk much about nukes, because for a conventional military that's powerful and is capable of fulfilling the mission assigned to it, you don't need nukes. You
right.
do need nukes when you're weak, and that's what Russia did in the 1990s, when the entire Russian military collapsed, when in Chechnya the Russians couldn't come up with a single regiment-level unit capable of actually fighting in Chechnya. All the money went to the nuclear forces, and they did maintain a force of road mobile ICBMs, which was the minimal, that they could do. They even sort of neglected the Navy and the Air Force to do. They really put all their efforts there to try to look still as scary as possible. That's exactly what we see today. The real emphasis on nukes today is a sign of no confidence and the ability of conventional U.S. armed forces to get anything usefully done for the United States. That's what I see under both of these documents.
Well, it's very interesting. My theory on why Bannon got booted out of the White House basically came down, I don't know if you saw his quote when he interviewed with CBS, but he basically said, why should we spend $1.5 trillion to upgrade the nuclear arsenal? Let's spend that money on fixing the inner city in Cleveland and Baltimore, and let's make America great again. You know, which was basically the fundamental issue that you and I have talked about for a year related to the campaign. Are we going to, you know, are we going to keep ballooning the military expenses, or are we going to turn around and do something to make America work? And I think it was one of the reasons Bannon really got booted, because you see tremendous number of people licking their chops over whatever that $1.5 trillion will go to. I'm not convinced it will all. I mean, nuclear technology is a legacy technology. Why would you put that much money in a legacy technology? Although I understand the arguments that it's, you know, it's what's going to make us most dangerous. But the reality is, if you, I don't know if you watch the State of the Union, but it looked to me like the generals looked scared to death. That did not look like a happy group of generals.
You know, budgeting and appropriations for the defense budget is really, you have to see one thing. The purpose is not to strengthen the U.S. military. The purpose is to spread the bonanza of corruption that creates for people who make a killing on it. I mean, the F-35 is the ultimate example, which I think is an extremely successful program. Of course, the aircraft itself is a flying brick, which is, you know, inferior to the previous generation in terms of warfighting, not in terms of fancy technology. But in terms of money, it's great. I mean, many people did a killing on that, and that's what we see here. But really, if you look at it, first of all, Bannon absolutely is correct. You could spend money on the infrastructure. But I would say from a purely military point of view, the only clear sign would have been what could have happened, which didn't happen, but the only rational strategy would be to first reconsidering the goals. And controlling the planet, I think, is self-evidently a militarily unsustainable objective. So what you do, you fall back on what are the threats to us and our allies. And basically, you try to get some strategy which is commensurate with the actual means of the country. This is a little bit what Trump hinted at when he said that NATO should start paying a bigger share. I don't think there's any threat to anybody in Europe, so I think NATO could basically be dismantled and brought down to zero, in my personal opinion, because there is no threat to Europe, at least no military threat from Russia for sure. There's this, you know, refugees are the real threat for Europe.
Right.
But that's kind of the logic that I want to say would have been more helpful, is say, what are the actual threats? How do we deal with them? And there are ways of dealing with a threat other than counter-threatening. It's called diplomacy.
If you look at the priority that the administration gave, it was to get the repatriation of the money back. And so what it looks like to me is they're planning on pulling back massive amounts of manufacturing and other activity behind, you know, the two oceans into Fortress America. And my question is, all of this a bluff while they cover their tracks to do that? You know, are they planning on I mean, clearly the Trump National Defense Strategy basically doesn't have America as a dominant unipolar empire, but just one of several countries competing, trying to compete successfully. So it's a multipolar vision of the world.
I disagree with you. I think it's a recognition that that's the threat, but it's not something that's been accepted as a fact of life that will have to be dealt with. I think the project is different. We will reassert worldwide control, and we will immediately challenge Russia and China to prevent them from building a multipolar world. I don't think it's going to work, but I don't think that I see no sign of acceptance of the reality, of the absolute inevitable reality, that the empire is going to have to be, you know, very substantially, at the very least, shrunk.
So let me bring this back to armies, because one of the things that I found very interesting reading both of your books, and I can't stress enough to the subscribers, I really recommend you get these books. But one of the things it comes back to is boots on the ground. And who can put boots on the ground that are effective? And you spent a lot of time talking about who can do that effectively. And it's a surprisingly small amount of nation states. But when I was reading Mattis's defense strategy, on one hand, I'm talking about him you know, I'm reading about him building an army that can be successful in putting boots on the ground in the 21st century. And then what I'm looking at is what is happening to the general population that is the population that is drawn from to produce soldiers. And frankly, if you are feeding soldiers from the age of one vaccines, GMO food, and, you know, entrainment and mind control, I don't understand where he thinks he's going to get his soldiers from. I mean, there's a disconnect here, which is, you know, maybe he thinks he can use all robots. I don't know.
Well, for one thing, there is a very high reliance on high technology. And it's not only because the U.S. has plenty of very good high technology, it's also because the simple war-fighting man, the grunt, you know, at the front line is not, how shall I put it, the comparatively best out there, to put it mildly. So the United States can put boots on the ground, but notice how they do it. It's always small groups of advisors, you know, special forces, etc. These are units that are technically boots on the ground, but they're not. They cannot do what, say, the Iranians or Hezbollah did in Syria, which is to go, we have a problem here, we're going to deal with militarily and send in troops that are actually going to fight hard, because ISIS is a very strong infantry force by now. They're very experienced. And win. This is not something that the United States has done for decades. I think the last time, in my opinion, was the Korean War. Maybe Vietnam. I don't know enough about it. Certainly during the Korean War, there was still that determination of the grunt to fight hard. But in modern wars, not at all.
Right.
In Iraq, money and corruption was the deal, the reliance on high tech. Then after 9/11 in Afghanistan, very typically the reliance of special forces, forward air controllers, and air power. Generally, the U.S. reliance on air power is very crucial. It's a kind of war that worked for a while and was actually successful. But when you're dealing with potential enemies such as the list that exists today, it's simply inapplicable. So you fall back again on more high tech, more money, and you try to minimize the engagement of conventional infantry type of forces, which is the last place you want to go, unless, of course, you have overwhelming advantage. I mean, you know, Panama kind of operations. Even Grenada was a mess. So I don't think the United States is actually, that's probably the weakest thing of the entire U.S. The U.S. is overstretched, is getting, U.S. armed forces are overstretched. They're getting a mission which is impossible under any circumstances to accomplish, which is control the planet. And I think they really have a problem in terms of ground forces.
Right.
They do way better in the air and Navy.
When the stopgap funding went forward and they're negotiating the new one now, there was a provision in there to waive the right of the House and Senate intelligence to see the full black budget. So they were asking for the ability to not report the black budget to House and Senate intelligence. I've got an interpretation of that. I think the interpretation is that they haven't been. They haven't been honestly reporting, and they're looking to create the statutory framework to basically be able to do what they've been doing, which is not fully complying with the law in terms of reporting to Congress what they're spending on the black budget.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me,
it seems extremely likely to be yes. Of course they haven't.
Right. So the secrecy is reaching an unbearable level given the expense. So, for example, I just did a Salera report on the pension funds. You know, it's a much longer, more complicated story, but essentially, we have $21 trillion missing from HUD and DOD. We have $24-plus trillion in bailouts. You know, all of that stuff, which I refer to as the financial coup, totals $50 trillion or more. The pension funds are only missing $5 trillion. What's the problem?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we have $50 trillion for those things, where we have no legal mechanism or no legal obligation to do anything, on things we have real contractual and legal obligations, why not? It's only 10% of $50 trillion. Why not just print the money? You know, if you look at the new military budget, there's clearly no problem in just printing the money.
So, yeah, that's exactly it.
Right. So there is no pension fund crisis. There's a plan, you know.
And,
to shift.
Of course, you know, that kind of secrecy, is coming back to what we discussed at the beginning, is the perfect cover for corruption. So I think only a small part of that money will actually go to improve the warfighting capabilities of the U.S. military. unless it's sexy programs which generate even more stuff like the F-35 or the Zoom World or things like that, which are, you know, corruption bonanzas. But all this black ops, all this, you know, special force, all this covert operations are a fantastic way of hoarding away huge sums of money. So while it will, again, benefit a specific number of people, you know, all of the elites, essentially, will that help really the armed forces to accomplish their mission? I don't think so. Not at all.
Well, I think part of the reason, Saker, is they found it cheaper to buy people than to have wars with people. In other
That's
words,
true.
Right.
There are some countries where that works very well. I think of Afghanistan and Iraq as two examples. But clearly with the DPRK, this is headed nowhere, or Iran, or for that matter, Russia right now. So there's a limit to that. But that has been historically a much more effective tool. Corruption has been way more effective to realize American foreign policy goals than the use of force.
Right. Right. And I think that's what they've been using the defense budget as an air cover for the money to buy everybody and everything to the extent they can.
Yeah.
And you're right. They're running, you know, I think you're hitting, the question is, are you hitting the limits of secrecy? Probably. Are you hitting the limits of who you can buy? Probably. And the reality is it's not getting, you know, it's not as easy to print money going forward as it has been. Let me just quickly ask, where do you think we stand now in terms of relations with North Korea, Russia, and Iran?
Terrible, and I think it's just going to get worse. I think that that confrontation is so essential for both the empire ideologically and the corruption scheme that we've been discussing, that this is what makes the entire system possible. I don't see any form of collaboration, though in reality, when needed, it does happen. We saw it recently with the trip of three top Russian intelligence officials to the United States, who clearly met with their American counterparts. So there is still collaboration happening, and the Iranians and Americans have always been talking to each other. And there's no doubt in my mind that the North Koreans and the Americans are also talking to each other, albeit through maybe covert channels going through Russia and or China. So there is a dialogue happening on pragmatic, you know, when circumstances require that. But officially, I don't see any chance for improvement. You would have to change the entire narrative. It's like admitting that 911, you know, was done by a controlled demolition. It's just not going to happen, regardless of the facts and how much is known about it. It becomes part of the crucial national narrative. These things don't change without regime change.
So there's a lot of interest. I'm very interested. Joseph Farrell's very interested. Our subscribers are very interested. There's a steady, you know, steady footprints of people headed down to Southern Americas, down to Argentina, to Chile, to Antarctica. And if you look at the $21 trillion missing from HUD and DOD, a lot of those systems for that period were run by Lockheed Martin right after the $6.5 trillion goes missing in fiscal 2015. They spin their IT division and the corporate liabilities thereon out to a new company that SAIC had created to do the same thing. And that company has major contracts in Antarctica. And what we all keep asking is, what in the world's going on in Antarctica and at the southern tip of the Americas? You have any thoughts on that?
No, because I'm really not a specialist at all of the region, which I visited Argentina and Argentina pretty well. About the details, no, I really don't. All I know is that this is a very, in terms of natural resources, a very interesting region for sure. And unfortunately, the United States has managed to regain control of a number of countries. That's actually one of the few successes of Obama in terms of putting pro-American regimes back in power. So I think there has been a successful push. That's the only foreign policy success of Obama, in a bad way, but it is a success for him, is the at least partial retake under control of Latin America. Therefore, it would make sense to create, again, a local elite which would benefit from financial and technological benefits from the U.S. presence, and the U.S. trying to impose its presence on a generally very rich and wealthy region. But I have not been following the details of that at all, so that's about all I can say.
Well, it's very hard to get any really reliable information. Okay, so let's talk about what's going on in the Middle East. You've been following what has been happening in Syria. Bring us up to date on Syria and what's been happening in the Middle East.
Well, I think we're on plan D, depending on how you count. We had plan A, B, C, and now D. One was to overthrow, obviously, the Syrian government. That didn't work. Then the idea was to partition the country. That didn't work. I mean, all sorts of things didn't work. The last was actually a repeat of what the U.S. tried to do in Iraq, which is to create some kind of Kurdish entity that, A, would secure the U.S. presence there locally, and secondly, to put all the countries the United States is trying to put under pressure by means of that Kurdistan. And, of course, that completely flopped because there's a basic rule that the United States seems to completely ignore, is when you go into a region to try to get something done, you cannot simultaneously directly oppose all the regional powers, all the actors that make sense. How anybody in the White House could seriously think that creating some kind of Syrian Kurdistan would be acceptable to Syria, to Turkey, to Iran, to Iraq, or even Russia is just beyond me. And they just had failed in Iraq, and they immediately repeated the exact same exercise in Syria. And, of course, it was an embarrassing failure because the Turks went, no way. And we saw something very interesting happening. We saw the Turks hopping into a plane, going to Moscow. I suspect very strongly that the Iranians were present at that discussion, and almost the next day it was crystal clear that the Russians, and I think the Iranians too, gave their go-ahead because the Turks immediately sent a military force in. The Russians, who actually in that north of the country have a very strong air defense network, didn't even bother tracking air, and the Turks flew there with complete impunity, which tells me that they had guarantees from the Russians that was just fine. It was the latest in a series of embarrassing, absolute disasters for the United States, and I think it's still headed nowhere. I don't see any kind of semi-reasonable plan, because the way to deal with any context is you have to, first of all, work with the local powers. That's the key thing. And in Syria, that means, at the very least, you have to have the Turks and the Iranians on board. I mean, right. That's the absolute minimal set. Iran is a country, for instance, in the Middle East that can get anything it wants done, but it can absolutely veto anything. They have enough power locally for that. The Turks are not quite as powerful. They've lost a lot of power over the past couple of years, but they still are. For one thing, they have real boots on the ground. They can use them. They're not as powerful as they were, but they still are. So they're politically, Iran and Turkey are the big ones, and of course, they are militarily very strong and capable of doing what's needed on the ground. The U.S. is ignoring them both. Well, that's what you get.
If you sit back and look at the big picture, Obama at the end was very frustrated with Israel, trying to make a deal with Iran, and his message was basically, we've got to get ourselves out of the Middle East and move on to, you know, to doing the productive things in this world. Look at what's going on in Asia. Let's be a part of that. And, you know, this notion that we can spend trillions of dollars and get embroiled in the Middle East is nuts. You know, mm-hmm. and you saw real tensions with Netanyahu. I mean, if anybody was trying to make America great again in this respect, it was Obama, not Trump. Trump's gone the opposite. And we're totally embroiled in the Middle East and, you know, helping Israel make a mess. And here we go again.
Well, we'll see, the biggest failure was to antagonize Erdogan and Turkey. Because Israel and the Saudis, which are the two only countries that matter and that are allies to the United States, are actually all three very similar. You know, we'll discuss the high-tech, the no boots on the ground, right. Et cetera. They're like that. They're absolutely not capable. Their militaries, for instance, are experts at shooting the civilians, be it Palestinians or Shia, depending on the country. They're not very good in actually getting boots on the ground and getting anything done there. You look at the Saudis in Yemen or the Israelis in southern Lebanon, I mean, you immediately see their limitations. And the U.S. had one country, of course not Iran, for, you know, historical reasons, but Turkey was the one country that the U.S. could and did use. At the beginning, the U.S. used Turkey very effectively to create ISIS, to funnel money, et cetera, towards them. But then they did something which just baffles me. They clearly were in support of the coup against Erdogan, and that's something that possibly might have lost them Turkey. And the loss of Turkey really hurts very badly, because right. Now the U.S. has no way of getting anything done. The Turks were crucial for NATO. The Turks were crucial for the Middle East. They were the real, and I'm not even discussing the importance of Incirlik and radio and, you know, reconnaissance flights and radars.
Right.
Turkey was truly and absolutely crucial.
What was the goal of getting rid of Erdogan?
Honestly, I don't understand how could, I mean, I have no explanation for it. I really don't.
Right.
Some kind of ideological, I think Erdogan, I mean, the guy is not exactly my idea of a nice person or somebody that's reliable. I understand that he's not an ideal ally, but he's
right.
So important, and Turkey is so important that I can't fathom who came up with that goofy concept and why they went ahead and did it. I mean, I really can't, because the risks were huge.
Right.
I can only explain that by a gross miscalculation. I guess they were hoping to get a more, you know, an easier, better, even more compliant Gulenist type of regime in power. But if that was the calculation, my God, do they know anything about the Turks and, you know, the kind of person Erdogan is? They're tough.
So let's turn to Russia, because the much of your new book focuses on helping an American really understand, or somebody who's from the G7 nations understand Russian. I think it was really very helpful to me. The political impact, what's been the political and economic impact on the U.S. sanctions? And we have more proposed U.S. sanctions. Bring us up to date on the Russian economy, the Russian politics and sanctions.
Well, originally the sanctions, and I would argue the fall, a combination of three things did definitely hurt Russia. The sanctions, yes. I think internal corruption and mismanagement, which still is very present in Russia, made it worse. Bad
right.
economic policies. I'm very not happy with the way the Russian economy is run. And the fall in oil prices. This combination certainly impacted Russia, but I would argue in a very helpful way. Because it forced the Russians to do a number of things which they were very reluctant to do. And you might have noticed in my first book and the second one, I speak that there's basically two camps in Russia. One
right.
which we could call, you know, the sovereignist, if you want. I call them Eurasian sovereignist. Those who want Russia to become a truly independent state, which still is not in economic terms. And the second group, which I call the Atlantic integrationist, who want Russia to be an equal partner accepted in the Western security establishment. Well, the sanctions, all these events were a devastating hit on the pro-Western group who was so opposed to real reforms. And what happened was Russia was forced to do a number of things, to develop an internal market, to seek new sources of credit. A whole list of things that Russia badly needed to do was started. I think, don't you say in the U.S. you make virtue out of necessity?
Right.
That's the U.S. expression, right? Well, that's what happened. And the latest sanctions are truly a blessing, because one of the problems was that a lot of oligarchs had put their money abroad. And Putin has been warning for years about that. Guys, be careful. The laws on offshores. Be careful. Your holdings abroad. Sooner or later, the way this is headed, it's going to be repeated. It's not only going to be Cyprus. What the U.S. did with the latest is basically put a bullseye on every single, on basically the top Russian elites, the entire
right.
government and Kremlin and all the Russian business community. They're actually helping Putin and the sovereignists bringing that money back to Russia as fast as they can possibly. So it's been an absolute blessing. I can't think of anything that anybody in the West could have done that would be more helpful for Russia than that kind of those sanctions, just as the anti-Russian rhetoric tremendously helped Putin to defeat the pro-Western opposition. I mean, it's been a windfall for the Eurasian sovereignists. And that's why they're going to do great. They're still doing very well in terms of opinion polls. And Putin will just do just fine in the elections. Even though, actually, internally, there are real problems in Russia. And Russians
right.
are, you know, unhappy with many problems. It's not a perfect society by any means. But all the West is achieving is helping Russia and helping Putin.
Well, what you're seeing is a repatriation of cash back into the United States and back into Russia.
Yep.
You know, it's a reverse, it's a partial reverse of globalization. Everybody's trying to become more self-sufficient. And oil prices are up. You know, oil prices are up about 8% so far this year. Okay, Ukraine. Tell us what's going on in Ukraine and what you think will happen in Ukraine over the next year.
Well, that's a very scary situation because, unfortunately, if you look at the different conflicts that the United States has triggered and is involved with, making the worsening of the situation in the Ukraine is one thing that has very little consequences for the U.S. or for the empire. In other words, they have very little to lose of a degradation of the situation there. Secondly, it has to be, it flows out of the rhetoric about the Russians being, you know, responsible for every evil in the universe. The U.S. clearly now is siding and becoming really a party to the conflict overtly. It always has been from the get-go, from Baku and Kiev. But now it's completely overt, both in language and statements and in delivery of weapons, which are mainly symbolic, really. But it sends a message. And what's been happening is that the Ukrainians have been preparing for a reconquista of the eastern Ukraine. And this is a very scary situation because I was always contended that the real goal of the regime in the Ukraine of attack would not as much be the actual victory, because what you have there is a population which is extremely hostile to the kind of nationalist Nazis in power in the rest of the Ukraine. You have an infrastructure that used to be very wealthy that's tremendously suffered from the war, so there's not anywhere near as much wealth as you had in the past. So what's the point other than, you know, putting the flag and saying we freed our territory? The real point is to force the Russians to intervene. And that's what's really scary. There's basically three possible scenarios if what I think will happen. I think a full-scale attack will happen. I say full-scale because we had constant attacks all year long. I mean, it's nothing new. They have this new strategy called, you know, frog jumps, I think would be the translation in English, where they seize villages in the neutral zone which are not defended and present that as a big victory for the Ukrainian armed forces. Well, if the big thing happens, we're talking about a move of, you know, on the size of 100,000 people moving in just on one side to start the war, or more, actually, depends on how you calculate. Scenario number one, the best one we can hope for, is that the Nova Russians, the people of Donbass and Lugansk republics, actually manage to stop that attack. That would be the ideal thing. If that happens, you can always blame Russia for backing them and saying they couldn't possibly have succeeded if it wasn't for Russian intervention. Okay, that's the best case. The next case is, no, it actually fails. And you see the Ukrainian offensive being successful. At that point, Russia has to intervene. She has no other solution. Putin will have to, and I mean intervene really, overtly, right. not by volunteers, not by sending equipment. It actually means the Russian armed forces move in. Of course, that will stop the war, and that will be done in a couple of days, because, you know, the Ukrainian army is not what it could have been. But can you imagine the consequences political in Europe? That would immediately right. stop the full dialogue. I mean, the Cold War would go through the roof. It would become tepid and even warm, and it would create a tension. The next two decades would be all about tensions in Europe. And so, unfortunately, I think this is a very real situation. And the Ukrainian parliament has adopted a law which says that there is no more anti-terrorist operation anymore, which implies an internal conflict. They call it occupied territories. They call the Nova Russians, they don't call them terrorists, they call occupation administration. And basically, it's given the president full powers to launch an attack anytime he wants. And that would be, you know, a war against Russia, which Russia couldn't possibly lose, of course. In military terms, it would be a no contest. But imagine the political consequences. If look what happened over the past, 4 years now, where no Russian intervention, there was no real Russian intervention in the Donbass. There were a couple of artillery strikes and some special operations. That's it. But imagine if actually you have Russian units going right. there.
So one of the things you pointed out in the new book is the danger of Russia being so dependent on one person. So we see a leader who has tremendous support among the general population and has been able to do, given what they had to work with, remarkable things since he was first elected and has been in power in and out for a very long time now, and we expect we'll win the election, and so we'll be there till 24. But one person is not a system. And if you look at all that Russia has to deal with and struggle with, given you know, given Putin's problems with what you call the Atlanticists, and given the fact he's only one person, how do you create a system in Russia whereby Russia can literally maintain its sovereignty over the long term?
It is extremely hard, and that's by far the biggest danger. So far, thanks to the very aggressive Russophobic policies, rhetoric of the West, they did more, you know, in terms of campaigning for Putin than any ads that he might put on TV.
Right.
I would say the best hope right now is that his worldview becomes mainstream in Russia. And that, to some degree, I would say is true. The pro-Western forces are in the range of 2 to maybe 3, 4, maybe 5%, depending on the region. It's much higher in bigger cities. But generally, I don't think there's ever coming back to the time in the early 90s where the Russians were standing in line and thinking that eating a McDonald's, a Big Mac, is, you know, heaven on earth, and that the planet loves them. Their problem was communism, and as soon as we get rid of communism, the West will embrace us. That's not happening again. But unfortunately, those elites, those pro-Western fifth columnists, are absolutely still present there. You look at the latest list of sanctions, there are some really notorious people like Nabiullina, head of the Russian Central Bank, or Chubais, a 1990s oligarch that's still in power. They're not on the list. And these people have a lot of money and a lot of influence still. And I unfortunately don't see, there are very good people around Putin, no doubt about it. But I don't see anybody who has that unique combination of being, you know, an iron-willed leader with an ability to speak to the people and really convince them. I just don't see it right now. That is, I think, by far the biggest threat for Russia.
You know, to a certain extent, if you look around the world and you look at a complex level, this is coming down to who can be bought and who can't be bought.
I absolutely agree. Yes, that's one very good way of putting it.
Right.
Idealist versus corruptible people.
Right. And the corruptible people, God, you almost can't believe how stupid they are, given that a lot of them are very well educated and have high IQs.
Yes.
But no, I used to see it in Washington. You couldn't believe that you were having to explain the most basic fundamentals of why it was within interest to have law. I mean, I used to remember telling Jack Kemp called me in once and wanted to know. He said, look, you know, here's our solution. You know, we don't have the money to fund keeping the low income restrictions on these properties. So we'll just take them. We'll just seize them. Mm-hmm. What do you think? You know, it'll save a lot of money. And I said, well, Jack, I'm a Republican. And one of the reasons I'm a Republican is I believe in property rights, individual property rights. And I know you're interested in running for president. And where I come from, Republicans call that communism. And I think that would be a political problem on your campaign. And he looked at me and he said, oh, right. Never mind. Forget that. And the little staff assistant he had who'd come from the Heritage Foundation said, I told you not to call her. Every time you call her, you agree with her. And you know, a really great idea goes down the drain. And I walked in and I thought, I can't believe I'm having this conversation with a cabinet secretary. But that's what the neocons were like. You had to constantly come back and talk to them about why you wanted to pretend to obey the law.
Mm-hmm.
It was...
And abide by principles which you proclaim.
Right.
So similar between the USSR in the 80s and the modern United States is that everybody knows that the high principles proclaimed and engraved in stones and monuments and, you know, founding texts, everybody knows nobody in power believes in them. The people do. People still believe in values of democracy, etc. But everybody knows politicians couldn't give a hoot about it. And when a system does that, it eventually collapses.
Right. You cannot hold this together with force. Force is not, you know, sufficient.
Or corruption.
Right.
You know, and one example that comes to my mind immediately is the very first time, I was not at all a Middle East specialist in my career, but I spoke with one guy who had just come back from Lebanon, and he told me, you know, these Hezbollah guys, they're different. And I said, well, how is that? He said, they're not corruptible. They're the only ones. You should see everybody else. They're all corruptible except for these Hezbollah guys. And I went, that's interesting. And start studying them. And it's true. It's actually true.
How do they achieve it? I mean, it's a cultural phenomenon. How did they achieve that?
I think because they're first and foremost profoundly religious people who fear God and their conscience much more than they fear their fellow human being opinion or actions. And they know they can't lie to God. And that's what achieves that level of incorruptibility. An absolute, not for the public, you know, not for posturing, but a profound belief that God looks at you every moment of the day and that you'll have to give account of your actions. And that's your goal in life is to serve him. That's what makes incorruptible people.
Okay, so let me bring this down to money, because in a market economy, you know, the culture that has values would create the most equity value. And the reason that is not happening right now is we've created something called the Federal Credit Mechanism. And as long as it can print fiat currency, as long as the central banking warfare system works, and the amount of money you make from printing fiat currency is less than the military expenses you're paying, you can defy, you know, you can create equity value from force essentially and maintain it. The problem is that what you're seeing is that balance reverse, the military expenses becoming greater than the benefits you're getting from the fiat currency. That's causing a lot of the fighting and purging, because the, you know, there's not enough money to feed what is a growing level. It's all, the corruption is always growing. They always want more. And so the force model is hitting its limits, and the reality is the only way to maintain or grow equity is with real fundamental. In other words, peace ultimately makes more money than war. So they're hitting the wall of the central banking warfare model, and that's part of what you're seeing the Western elite struggle with. And it's one of the things you, to me, it's one of the drivers as to why China and Russia are cooperating more, and China is doing the, you know, the Silk Road, because they're looking for a way to build the alternative equity model and basically show up and say, we have capital and engineers, how can we help? So what's emerging here is the warfare model versus the equity model, and ultimately, if we're going to survive, the equity model has to win. But it's going to be a very ugly, chaotic fight.
But neither of the two models offers any kind of value that inspires people to actually die for it. I think that's the even much stronger element.
Well, because money, the economics,
money
is
not a value. Actually, I would put it this way: money is not a value.
Well, but I would say equity is a value, but it's a subservient value. In other words, you know, it's funny when you deal with very large portfolios and money, it all comes back to values, because value is created. You know, yes, there are material goods, there's land, water, resources we all need to eat, but a great deal of the economy comes from cooperation and trust, things that can only happen with the organization that comes from having trust, that comes from cultural cooperation or from law. And without that, you destroy the equity. We're watching a process going on around the world that's destroying equity. Now, it's covered up because you're printing money.
But the values you're referring to are values that are measured on a scale of their effectiveness for the welfare of a country, of a region, or a person. What I'm referring to is values that are not material-based to begin with, such as love, kindness, honor, sacrifice, service. I mean that kind of values that have no economic dimension whatsoever.
I think they're
much more powerful than any kind of value that is measured on an economic scale of pragmatic effectiveness.
So I'm going to disagree with you wildly. In other words, economic value is subservient, and the result, it emerges from those values. In other words, so scripture says faith is the substance of things hoped for but not yet seen. It is those values you're describing that is the source of everything, including essentially all economic value. And without them, economic value ultimately will go away or be destroyed. In other words, economy is a result, is one of the many results of those values. And without those values, there is no, you know, there's only liquidation.
That is absolutely true in one specific cultural context. But there are other cultures who would say that asceticism, repentance, dealing with your own weaknesses are the only important things in life, and economics don't even matter in any way, shape, or form. That's what Christ meant when he said, look at the lilies and how they're clothed. You know, he didn't say, try to find an economically sensible way of developing your lilies. So I think what's happening is that the West, who for hundreds of years for sure has been building a system of values which did result in fantastically successful technological and economic achievements, is now butting heads against something that would have been thought as part of the antiquity, which is bouncing right back, which is a system of values which are so fundamentally different that even the criteria are mutually exclusive, incompatible, and not understandable. Speaking about asceticism, self-restraint, or repentance is something that makes no sense at a Davos conference. See where I'm getting at?
Well, it does to the Quakers. I was raised a Quaker.
But look about Hezbollah. Look at people who think that every day is the place to make the highest possible sacrifice for God. They have a specific slogan which says, every day is Ashura, every place is Kerbala. When you deal with that kind of people, suddenly all the wisdom of the CIA analysts and the Pentagon planners and the economists and all of those who were successful elsewhere, suddenly they break their teeth on it and the system doesn't work anymore. Because you're dealing with people who live in a completely different spiritual reality.
Well, what I would say is if you look at power on this planet, it is that spiritual reality which is the source of the greatest power. So, ultimately, I have no idea what's going to happen here, but force and technology won't do it. You have to know why you're here and what you're here to do, and without that power, it's never going to work. So,
well, just to irritate Islamophobes who might be listening to that, I would quote, first of all, the famous Allahu Akbar, meaning God is the greatest. And secondly, man makes plans. That's a quote from the Quran. God makes plans, but God is the better planner.
Yes.
And I love when Western, Islamophobes get absolutely irritated by a guy like me saying that. Let them be irritated, because that is actually more powerful than their entire culture. Just two simple concepts.
Well, but here's the challenge we have globally, because I think this is... I don't have the right words to describe it, but I think it's people who begin with, I live in a community. If you go to the mural that's across the street, you drive into Hickory Valley, there's a big mural, and at the bottom it says, it's from Corinthians. It says, whatever you do, do it for the glory of God. And so all around the world, whatever the religion, whatever the nation, we have people who are firmly planted in a spiritual reality and believe in law. And whether it's cultural law or legal, whatever, but they believe in law. If you look at the Soleri coin on one side of it, it says, do unto others as they would have you do unto you. If you look at almost all philosophies and credos, they all say that. How do we find each other and get something done here? And I think that ultimately is what's going to prevail, because that is the only impulse which to me can be the basis of a successful civilization. Or certainly an advanced civilization, and certainly a civilization that can handle the kind of technology we're looking at, which our civilization clearly can't. We are not capable of handling the technology that's coming, and in that is probably one of our greatest dangers. So,
the scripture says you can't serve Christ and Mammon, and a culture which puts a dollar value on absolutely everything is not a viable one. It's that simple.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say, it's not economically viable, among other things. Anyway, this has been a delightful conversation. If you could tell everyone, Saker, how to get your both books, because I for one would recommend, I will say this, one of the things you read in both books, and you really see it in the first book, is this idea of people who believe in a spiritual power and who believe in the law, finding each other globally from all different walks of life. You kind of thread them together in your website and your work.
I try to. I definitely try to. I think a pluralism of opinions is fundamental.
Right. I think maybe that's the emerging multipolar world, how we find each other.
God willing.
Okay, so tell us how to find your books.
You just go to my blog. It's called thesaker.is, thesaker.is, and you'll find all sorts of ways of ordering both books on it. Actually, the first one is now available for free download in PDF format, which I think is the easiest way of getting it. So you can look on the right-hand side, Saker's books. One you can order, the second one you can free download.
And you have a Saker community?
Yes, of different blogs, which has been tremendously helpful. A lot of people helping me. So the Saker blogs can be found in French, Russian, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, English, and Oceania. It's a separate group, same language, but different part of the world, and in Serbian.
And we can sign up to be a patron, correct?
Yes, you can.
Okay. Okay,
I'll be grateful if you did.
It's what I call a great investment.
Thank you.
Invest in your sanity. Any other thoughts about what we should look for in the next quarter before we talk with you again?
No, I think I would, Ukraine, Russia, as usual, is my worst, particularly with the upcoming World Cup.
Where's the World Cup going to be?
All over Russia. Different cities of Russia. So, frankly, for this summer, even more than usual, God help us all.
Okay, Saker. Well, it's been a delight. You have a great quarter, and we'll talk to you next quarter.
You too. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.